A colonial past. The frenzy of a shoot. And a mission to rewrite history. For centuries, the British Empire has shaped India's colonial story, erasing voices, bending truths. But that's changing now, thanks to a man who's challenging that narrative with conviction, clarity, and courage.
India's share of the world economy when Britain arrived.
May 2015, a speech echoes through Oxford halls. Words sharp enough to crack centuries of silence.
Oppress, enslave, kill, torture, maim people for 200 years and then celebrate the fact that they're democratic at the end of it.
This was the start of a reckoning. Now he returns to unravel the truth behind the empire's tale.
Hello, Dr. Shashi Tharoor.
Hey, nice to see you, Ranjit.
Nice to see you too. Are you ready to roll?
I'm ready to roll.
3, 2, 1, action!
His Oxford speech did not just break the internet algorithm, but it also shifted the global discourse on empire, the formidable Dr. Shashi Tharoor.
Hello, Ranjan. Good to be with you.
American presenter Tucker Carlson, he claimed on Fox News that when British pulled out of India, they left behind an entire civilization. He asks why, even after 75-odd years of independence, we couldn't produce a single building which is as beautiful as the Chhatrapati Shivaji Terminus that the British had constructed.
Oh God, what a fatuous comment. I mean, first of all, the British came to an established civilization, far more civilized than their poor, benighted little island when they left it. And they destroyed much of what they could find. But the question of asking why we couldn't build a building like the Shivaji Terminal, Victoria Terminus, as the British called it, is like asking the Americans, why in 200 years of independence have you never built anything as beautiful as the Taj Mahal? I mean, come on. Each society, each civilization, each culture has its own forms of architectural expression. And indeed, everything is now influenced by everything else. In fact, before the Taj Mahal, there was Humayun's tomb, which is, in my view, equally beautiful. You can go even further back, come to my constituency and see the Padmanabha Swami Temple, 1100 AD. Why have the Americans not built anything even close to that in beauty? Look at some of the extraordinary detailed sculptures on the temples of the south, the temples of Konark, Khajuraho for that matter. Why haven't Mr. Tucker Carlson's forebears been able to even approach anything like that? These are silly questions. Each society is different. It has different buildings, different artifacts. Let's just appreciate what the world has left behind for us and mourn the ones that were blown up by colonists, invaders, and conquerors. Go to the Elephanta Caves outside Mumbai and you will see how many statues were literally used as target practice by British soldiers. Bullets blowing off the noses and ears and part of the bodies of exquisitely carved statues, far, far, far greater and nobler than anything their society could have produced.
Well, another commentator, Ann Coulter, suggests that colonies owe Britain reparations. I'm saying that again. Colonies owe Britain reparations for railroads, for indoor plumbing, for saving Indians from practices like the sati pratha. Where do you even begin to set the record straight, Shashi?
I've addressed the railways claim at some length in my book because it's the favourite one of many people. And I'm certainly the other two we can dismiss in a minute. Nobody had indoor plumbing till the 19th century, not even Americans or British. Go and visit Theodore Roosevelt's house, for example, at the beginning of the 20th century, And they will show you there was no indoor plumbing. They had to literally construct water closets inside. Otherwise, people had to go out. That was simply the way the world was, and India was no different. When the world discovered indoor plumbing, we would have had it too. We didn't need to be conquered in order to acquire indoor plumbing, for God's sake. And the same with other reforms. Every society reformed at its own pace. There were Indian indigenous reform movements against Sati as well. Okay, so the British happened to conquer us and abolish it. But if they hadn't conquered us and abolished it, we would have got around to abolishing ourselves. The railways were built entirely for the advantages of the British. The official minute by the then Governor General, Lord Dalhousie, in proposing bringing railways to India, actually laid out very clearly that what they wanted was, number one, a means to have an easier access to the hinterland to extract raw materials, bring them to the ports to ship them to England. It was part of the loot. And the secondary purpose would be to be able to send troops into restless or rebellious portions of the country in order to quell them more easily. That was it. It was entirely about colonial extraction and colonial suppression. It had nothing to do with the benefit of the Indians, number one. Number two, the railways are built entirely on the backs of the Indians, with Indian taxes paying for every penny, practically, of the construction, whereas the profits entirely went to Britons living in England and buying shares in the railways and the stock exchange. It was the single most profitable investment in Britain in any London Stock Exchange transaction between 1845 and 1875 was to invest in the Indian railways. The railways were run entirely by the British. Indians did not even benefit in terms of employment from the lowliest ticket collector to the substation masters. Everyone was white and British. Right up to the First World War, that's when a lot of young British men got killed in the trenches in Europe, and they suddenly needed to hire people, so they started hiring Indians, and mainly Anglo-Indians, and occasionally a few others, but a handful. If you look at the 100-year history of the railways of Britain in India, the number of Indians even employed by the railways were very, very few. And fourth, the routes were designed for British colonial purposes and were not designed to help, for example, Indian passengers to move. Passenger compartments were added as an afterthought. First of all, there were first-class whites-only reserved compartments. Then they brought in some compartments for the Indian passengers, but they were herded in like cattle. If you want, that was the original cattle class. It was wooden benches or none at all. People shoved in, literally, like animals. And yet, they paid more. In terms of the then prevailing national income, they had the highest and most expensive passenger tickets in the world, whereas the British companies using the same trains for freight had the lowest and cheapest freight rates in the world. Now, all this is amply researched and documented. For the British to claim the slightest credit for having done any good to India through the railways is arrant hypocrisy.
So now you can't talk about British imperialism in India without talking about the East India Company. Now, this company had some 35-odd employees in their headquarters.
In the headquarters, but there are thousands in India, yeah.
And yet, this company managed to conquer, take over this entire subcontinent. Yeah. It's essentially an 18th-century version of a tech company like a Meta or an X. It's unthinkable today that a company would conquer a country, but that's
exactly... Meta has conquered the world, hasn't it? No, I mean, it's obviously unthinkable today, but, you know, there were a number of factors. First of all, the British came as a company to trade. They were a commercial venture. They had a charter from the Royal Court in Britain, and they came here to trade. And, in fact, don't forget that for... This is the East India Company was established in 1600, and the India had been trading with the world, particularly in fine textiles, cottons, linens, muslins, and so on, for literally more than 2,000 years before that. India was the world's leading exporter of fine cloth. Silks, too, in some places. Though China was more famous for silks, but we also had Indian silks. And muslin linen was so famous, it was said that Indian muslins were light as woven air. And there's a famous story of how you could pull a gauze through a ring. So these guys came to buy all that, and of course the traditional desire for Indian spices, particularly to preserve things before the invention of refrigeration. And so spices, particularly from the south, cloth from the rest of India, and of course they needed to get it out through ports because everything was sea trade in those days. So the East India Company comes, they try and establish a presence on the coasts, Surat first, Masulipatnam in the south, north towards what we now know as Kolkata. And what do? They start trading, which means that they have to bring money from England, they don't have too much of it, purchase goods in India, which they then took back to England and sold for 4 or 5 times the price they'd paid. That's how they made money, and that's how the company had begun to prosper. Through most of the 17th century, that's all the East India Company was, and if that was all the story was, we wouldn't have minded. But two things happened in parallel. First, they became richer. And by the way, though there were only 35 people at headquarters, they had their tentacles right across the British establishment. Something like 16% of British MPs in one particular year that I checked the figure were all shareholders in the East India Company, and I'm sure the figure was higher at different periods of the company's history. So by about 1700, and this is a time when India, by the way, accounted for 27% of global GDP, China was 23%, and Britain was 1.8%. In fact, in 1700, the revenues of the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb exceeded that of all the crowned heads of Europe put together, okay? Then they started establishing more significant presences near the ports. Why? Partially because the Indian rulers were so complacent that they didn't see any danger in this. So they would give them land. You know, they used to call them factories, but they were not factories in the sense of manufacturing anything. They were the traders of the East India Company, for some reason, were called factors. And so a factory was where they stayed and worked. So you started building factories near the ports, and little European settlements started growing up and all these, which then they sent armed people to fortify and everything else. And what happened was, in parallel, there was a massive decline of Indian political authority. After Aurangzeb, steady decline in the control by the Mughal Empire of their far-flung territories and provinces. And so increasingly, the people they had appointed as kind of provincial governors became rulers in their own. The Nizam of Hyderabad started off as an appointee of the Mughal Emperor. The Nawab of Bengal started off as an appointee of the Mughal Emperor. These guys all then became rajas, maharajas, kings, and conquerors in their own steam. And they started developing quarrels amongst themselves. So in this fractious atmosphere, you also had the rise of the Marathas, who had been in revolt against the Mughals going back to the mid-16th century under Shivaji. One of the first things they did was to get themselves a firman from the Mughal emperor, who couldn't be bothered to go and collect revenue in a far-flung province like Bengal, to collect the revenue for him. Now, what did the British do with that? They collected more revenue, far more revenue, than they were supposed to by raising rates, by extorting, by beating and torturing people who couldn't pay. And then they said, isn't it so much better, instead of trading with these Indians, to trade at the point of a gun? So they had the guns, they had the control, and they basically used the revenues that they were making from the Indians. So they're coming to you, taking your money at gunpoint, and then giving you your money to buy what you have to sell at a rate lower than you wanted to sell it for. It was a mafia operation, Runjun. You just cannot imagine the cynical way in which colonialism, the East India Company, converted itself from a relatively innocent trading company into an extortion racket. And that's what it became.
Historians have debated over it. Reddit threads have spiraled over it. The viral $45 trillion figure. Is that an accurate figure, Shashi?
£45 trillion is what Professor Ursa Patnaik calculated. And then somebody else more recently, I think just a couple of years ago, came up with billion dollars. The £45 billion was a figure she calculated, if I remember correctly, from roughly 1750 to 1900. So there was also more extraction thereafter in the 20th century. Now, I don't know. I'm not an econometrician. I'm not a scholar of numbers. But I will say two or three things. Number one, there was absolutely no doubt that there was money being extracted on an annual basis because the British East India Company actually meticulously kept accounts of the money they were repatriating back to their shareholders in London. So you know how much physical money went. Second, you know how little of it was invested back in India because they constructed practically nothing and there was no famine relief, for example, right well into the late 19th century. Third, you also know that there were incalculable losses from, for example, the payment of unfair prices. So if I used to buy your muslin, for argument's sake, for £10, and now, pointing a gun at you, I'm buying your muslin for £1, is there not a loss of £9 there? You could calculate that. Similarly, when I extract cotton from India, which you are no longer able to weave and make into cloth, ship it to England, run it through my mills and factories, and sell it back to you for a profit, how do you calculate the loss of that? I remember saying in my Oxford speech, first of all, that the putting of a monetary price on the damage done is wrong because the money only begins to capture a small portion of it. Secondly, how do you calculate the loss of human life? Third, how do you calculate the loss of lives in things like massacres? 150,000 men, women and children butchered in Delhi after the revolt of 1857. You're going to put a price on their lives? And then finally, any amount of money you come up with as a figure, any credible figure, and 45 is probably more credible than others, any credible figure is not payable. And any payable figure is not credible. And finally, the one simplest thing for them to do, and I demanded this when my book came out and I was touring England on my book, I said, the one thing you folks have never done is just say sorry. Apologize for the wrongs that you have done. And they said there's a great occasion coming up, the centenary of the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, one of the most shameless atrocities in the history of a regime riddled with evil and killing, was the Jallianwala Bagh massacre. I was speaking in 2017. I said, April 13, 2019, perfect opportunity. One of you should apologize. I even partly joked that, you know, okay, if you think that a politician like a prime minister would be unwilling to do that, get a member of the royal family because everything was done in the name of the crown. And I half jokingly said, send Meghan Markle over to apologize. We don't mind. It's the apology that matters. But anyway, Meghan Markle's no longer in the royal family. And the British prime minister finally spoke in the House of Commons on that day, the centenary of the massacre, and gave a very mealy-mouthed expression of regret for the events of that day. I mean, if Hitler had said, you know, I regret the events that took place in Auschwitz, I mean, would anybody have considered that an apology? I'm sorry, I don't.
Now, Shashi, since through this conversation we're trying to get into the colonial mindset, it would be hard not to mention Mr. Churchill. Now, he has said a awful lot of bad things about Indians. He's gone on to say that Indians are beastly people with a beastly religion. Do you think it was just old school racism or was it more than that? Was it a strategic plan to impose domination?
The man was an out and out racist. About that, there is no doubt. He was a vile, vile character. I mean, I've often had quarrels with English people who revere him as some sort of freedom of fighter for freedom and democracy. I said, this is a Democrat? A man who came and did what he did to us, what he did to the Irish, what he did to the Mesopotamians, a man who went to Italy in the 1920s, praised Mussolini and fascism and said that if Britain ever reached the condition of Italy, he hoped that Britain would find its own Mussolini. This man is a man who's a hero of democracy. I find it pathetic, hypocritical and dishonest on the part of the Brits to exalt this evil figure who, to my mind, stands amongst the worst oppressors and tyrants of the 20th century. But having said that, yes, he said all the things you said. Worse, he denied food aid to starving Indians during the famine of 1943 to 44, the Great Bengal Famine, as it was called, caused principally a British extracting grain from Britain and sending it off to Europe and to England at that time in order to enhance buffer stocks for their troops as fighting was going on. And when conscience-stricken British officials wrote to him saying that because of your decisions, there are people literally dying in the streets before our eyes, he wrote in the margin of the file, why hasn't Gandhi died yet? That's the kind of man you're dealing with. Could anything be more reprehensible? His own Secretary of State for India, Lord Amery, wrote in his private diary in 1944-45, I cannot tell the difference between Churchill and Hitler. And that's his own minister in his own cabinet.
Now, Shashi, also in your blockbuster viral Oxford speech, you'd mentioned that around 1.3 million Indians had served in World War I, and yet there's barely any recognition. Why do you think that is?
Well, there were two problems at that time. First of all, of course, for the British, it was a European war fought between Europeans, and our soldiers were essentially cannon fodder. So they had no desire to recognize the sacrifices, even though the honest truth is that at the very beginning of the war, they were so unprepared that they had to divert a ship that was sailing to Cairo with Indian soldiers with cotton uniforms for the heat of North Africa and Egypt, to France and to Belgium in order to stop the German advances. The first few battles of the First World War were all fought by Indian soldiers. And they were able to stem the tide of the German advances in Neuchâtel, in Ypres, in many other battles. But the British never gave them credit because they wanted the story of their own heroism and their own sacrifice and their own valor to be told. That was on the British side. 74,000 Indians lost their lives. Another 175,000 were severely wounded, injured, maimed for life. Okay? But there was also a problem back home. Because when these Indian soldiers were fighting in the First World War, the British had, in their own cleverly drafted formulation, promised India in return a transition to responsible self-government, by which every Indian leader, including Mahatma Gandhi, understood that India would get dominion status like Australia, Canada, South Africa at the end of the war. And so Mahatma Gandhi actually urged Indians to go and fight because he said, you're fighting for India's freedom, you're going to get freedom at the end of the war. War ended, Britain won, and they broke their promise. Perfidious Albion, that's how they behaved.
Also, Shashi, there are some Redditors who've started wondering whether colonialism was even worth it economically, or was it more of a drain than gain?
That's a preposterous argument.
Mm-hmm.
I remember quoting in the book an account by a British writer in the 1790s who took a carriage ride down a couple of prominent thoroughfares in London, counting the number of mansions, buildings, and great monuments built with Indian money. The Britain is just dotted with the visible representations of loot from India. And what is more, look at the actual numbers. In the 250 years of British presence in India, their GDP per capita grew by 347%. India shrank. Okay, so you're looking at a country which was one of the most prosperous, richest countries in the world, as I said, in 1700, 27% of global GDP, as late as 1800, 23% of global GDP. And when the British left, 1.8%. Now, this is not high-level mathematics. You can see the difference. Britain went from being this really poor, benighted, desperate, underdeveloped country into this great outpost of human civilization, prosperity, gold, and commerce. And India became a poster child for third world destitution, poverty, disease, malnutrition, and suffering.
Dr. Shashi Tharoor, it's a quick true or false. I start with, when the British arrived to the Indian subcontinent, formal education was virtually zero. True or false?
False. There's a lot to be talked about. We should probably have an entire conversation on education. India, first of all, had the oldest universities in the world. I mean, Nalanda was attracting foreign students from places as far west as Persia and Turkey and as far east as Korea and Japan. We're talking about in the 7th, 8th centuries AD, okay? If you look before that, Takshashila goes back to the time of Christ. Vikramshila. There were at least half a dozen universities I could name. Yes, if you were to say the British, in terms of their formal education system, found no equivalent in India, arguably you could make that case. But then what did you do about it? You see, the British, Will Durant, the American historian, traveled to India in 1930. He was researching his book on human civilization, the story of civilization, famous 7 or 8 volume study of human civilization. He came to India, and he was so horrified by what he discovered that he put aside his work on the civilization book and wrote a book about British colonialism in India, which he considered one of the greatest abominations and evils he'd ever seen in human history. And he mentioned that the entire educational budget of the British in India in 1930, at every level of instruction put together, was less than New York State was spending on high school education at that very year.
Billions of people now live better lives than they would have lived had Europeans not colonized the globe. True or false?
More complicated than that. There were certainly a number of European inventions from which the whole globe has benefited. There were advances in modern medicine. Alexander Fleming discovering penicillin in India. Right? I mean, this is something which all of us who've taken penicillin shots or antibiotics should be grateful for. Did he have to conquer India to do it? I don't believe so. He could have come here and worked, and some rich Maharaja could have hired him, and he could have found out penicillin by researching it here if he wanted to. I mean, I'm just saying, I don't think that any of these great advances actually justify colonialism, because you don't need to be colonized to invent jet engines. You don't need to be colonized to invent, you don't need to be a colonialist to invent antibiotics. You don't need to go and conquer and oppress people in order to be able to create some of the modern technologies that today have made the globe a better place.
Dr. Shashi Tharoor, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ranjan. We'll continue talking. All the best.
We've only begun to peel back the layers. The British didn't just rule. They looted, erased, and rewrote our story for centuries. The truth is waiting to be told. Remember, history belongs to those who rise to tell it.